Good afternoon once again. We'll go ahead and begin the study. The prayer was asked on the study, so we'll begin taking a look at the subject here. And so the title of the Bible study is The King of the South, Part 2. And we began a study in the month of December, so we'll continue this and conclude today with what I have to say about it. And the reason that I continued this study in a second part is because you continue to have upheaval in the Muslim world, which is the territory of the King of the South. And, you know, as we look at all of this, we have to ask, you know, are we seeing the rise of the King of the South, and how will it all unfold? So we'll see how it goes. And that's the end of it, because I don't have my little clicker. If you can't click, there's no way you're going to keep going. So anyway, so in today's study, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do a quick review. We're going to look at some ironies. We'll see a couple of them that we already looked at. And then we're going to look at some demographics, because demographics is an interesting issue that applies to this. And then we're going to see some final thoughts. And after we're, so that'll take us through to the end. Now, review. First of all, as we saw last time, we saw at in Daniel, it tells us at the end of the age there will be a conflict between the king of the north and the king of the south. And Daniel 11 all the way through talks about the king of the north and the king of the south and the interactions that took place from them. We know anciently that the area of Syria, which was dominated by a general called the Seleucus, his descendants ruled over that area all the way to India for a while, and they battled a group known as the general's descendants known as the Ptolemies, who were in Egypt. And so there was conflict between these two kingdoms for quite a period of time, and it's important because Israel was in the middle. And the armies would go back and forth, and Israel would suffer the consequences depending on who was in power. And so the most famous king of the north is Antiochus Epiphanes. We know that he is associated with the abomination that makes desolate. We know that his goal was to destroy the true religion. He sought to stamp it out and establish the Greek way of thinking and religion, and eventually was defeated by the Jews. And from that, we know Hanukkah and all of that stems from that particular period of time. And Antiochus Epiphanes is a type of the beast that is to come. The way he conducted himself in anger and all of the things that he did, he's a type of the beast of the end of the age. The king of the south has and will push at the king of the north. The king of the south is pushing at the king of the north almost daily, it seems. And it's happening very often. Now, the interesting thing is, you look at things historically, the king of the north was eventually conquered by Rome. Okay, they eventually conquered the empire of Seleucus, and so they've continued to they were never, that territory was never conquered. The Catholic Church and the Holy Roman Empire continued to hold sway there. However, the king of the south, they were Greeks at one time, but eventually they were conquered by the Muslims, and the Muslims still dominate that territory. And so it lends credence to the fact that it's very possible that the king of the south is going to be from that area, and the religion of the king of the south will be Islam. So we see that this area that's on the map is going to be a center point in the future, especially the area around Jerusalem. And that's yet to be played out. We see that there's going to be a king of the south, and there will be a king of the north, and who will dominate the area of Europe. The Middle East and North Africa is going to be dominated by the king of the south, it appears. So Revelation 17 portrays that closely aligned with the king of the north is going to be what organization? The Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church is going to be aligned with the King of the North and is going to be very influential with that king. And why would the King of the North want to be aligned with and controlled by a religious entity? There are a couple of reasons for that. Why would it want to be aligned with and controlled by that entity? What's that? Unity. Right. Religion is going to bind it together. It's going to be a kingdom of iron and miry clay, it says, and the religion is going to help to bind it together. Interestingly, as you look at Europe, as I think I said last time, you wonder how people that are not religious are going to respond to religion. And they are not religious, but they're very superstitious. So if you have some signs and wonders done, it's going to be something that is going to draw them to it. There's still a Catholic base there, but it's not like it was at one time. So it's going to bind this loose political alliance together, draw the 10 kings that are spoken of in the book of Revelation together. And because of the nature of the King of the South, it may force a religious alliance between those kings who will form the King of the North. So the chief impetus to the King of the South is going to be religion, as we talked about last time. They're going to push at the King of the North, and the chief entity that's fought against the King of the South has been the Catholic Church, over historically speaking. And the Catholic Church is again going to seek to rally the King of the North to fight against the King of the South. So something to keep your eye on in the future. As I said, who dwells to the south? The area to the south there is the Middle East and Northern Africa. And as we spoke of last time, Islam is the religion of the King of the South. And Islam, as you look at the Quran and you study the Quran, people tell you Islam is a religion of peace, and most people are peaceful. But if you look at the Quran and you follow it as the Quran instructs you, then it is not a religion of peace. The goal of Islam is worldwide conquest and to establish Islam everywhere, the whole world under Islam. That's the goal. So as the Islam came out of the Middle East in the 600s, it began to expand, and it expanded very quickly out beyond the area where Muhammad originally was. And the goal was to bring everybody into the fold and to spread Islam worldwide, and that is the goal of Islam currently. Islam, as I said, spread all the way across North Africa. It spread up into Spain and was headed toward Paris. But just outside of Paris, a man by the name of Charles Martel rallied the Frankish army, and they stood together and they defeated the Moors at the Battle of Tours and drove Islam back. And otherwise, Islam would eventually have conquered the world, and we would all be Muslims at this particular time. But it was not God's purpose that that would be achieved. So Charles Martel turned them back, and a wonderful exposition on that is by Victor David Hansen in the in a book that he wrote. He wrote an excellent book that my son told me about from taking a class at Ohio State, and so I'm a Victor Davis Hanson fan, and I can't think of the book right off the top of my head because it's not in my notes, but it's excellent and kind of gives you a description of what took place there. So one of Charles Martel's descendants, his name was Charlemagne, and the Muslims were defeated in 732 and driven back across the Pyrenees back into Spain, where they continued to dominate there until 1492. But the Muslims continued to push at the King of the North, and the Pope was very worried about the pushing at the King of the North. So what he did is he said, well, I'll align myself with the King of the North. And so what he did was to anoint Charlemagne, Charles the Great, as the emperor, as a Roman emperor in 800 A.D. That was Pope Leo III, and the Pope then used the armies of the King of the North to fight against the King of the South, to thwart them and to turn them back. And as you think about that, it took a resurrection of the Roman Empire, now called the Holy Roman Empire, to turn back the King of the South. And in fact, as we look at history, you come to realize that there are several resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire that occurred for the express reason of turning back Islam, as it began to push into Europe, and several different major battles, they took place and turned back Islam. As you look at the Crusades, the purpose for the Crusades, again, was to turn back Islam. It was a battle between the King of the North and the King of the South. The chief objective for many of the Crusades was the conquest of Jerusalem, and eventually they did conquer Jerusalem and hold on to it for about 100 years, but then the Muslims pushed them out and maintained dominance over the area for about 800 years. And then as you look at Muslim dominance in North Africa and the Middle East, they've dominated that area for about 1,200 years. But Jerusalem is a real focal point and has been a focal point. As the Muslims took over Jerusalem, they tore the churches down or built churches over where, or mosques over where churches were at. And they established the most famous of the mosque, which is the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the top of the Temple Mount. As I said, the caliphs ruled the south for over 1,200 years. They ruled until World War I. And at the end of World War I, the Ottoman Empire was dismantled. And from that point forward, the Middle East and North Africa were dominated by the West, primarily by the British and the Americans, although the Italians and the French were also involved in the dominance of that part of the world. And these Westerners came in and divided up the territory and all of that, which the Muslims, as they look back on it, find it very offensive. And that's part of, they're called Crusaders. That's why they call us Crusaders. We came in and sought to impose our will upon them. But the most egregious thing that happened for the people of Islam was that in 1948 Israel was established. And so the Muslims were greatly humiliated when the Jews were granted a nation right in their very midst. This was a humiliating thing. They went to war against Israel as soon as the nation was established. They were defeated. And they continued to try to defeat Israel. And up to this point they failed. They took heart as the Israeli nation was established, thinking, well, at least we control Jerusalem. Well, that all went south on them, and it should be the Six-Day War. Sorry I couldn't fix that before the study. Steve Arnold pointed out he's reading a book about the subject, and it is the Six-Day War. So anyway, the Six-Day War ended in Jerusalem being taken by Israel. And that was the ultimate slight for the Jews. The Jews took control of Jerusalem for the first time in 800 years. So the big question that was asked for in Islam was this: why does Islam suffer defeat at the hands of the infidels? Why isn't Allah blessing us? Now, I answered this last time. Does anybody remember why the conclusion they came to? Why isn't Allah blessing them? Right. They stopped pushing at the King of the North. They stopped. They gave up global conquest. And they had been docile for a while. And so the conclusion was reached that Allah will only bless us if we engage in jihad in order to bring the whole world under the auspices of Islam. And that is the goal of Islam. Whether we want to recognize it or not, that is the goal. And if you look at the Quran, that's what it tells you. So the recognizing that Allah was not blessing with them, then the jihad began in earnest. One of the first shots fired in that war was in 1972 at the Olympics in Munich, where Palestinians went into the Olympic Village and killed several Israeli wrestlers and some policemen, a policeman, and that was one of the opening shots of the current war that is going on in between the King of the North and the King of the South. And you have to realize we are aligned with the King of the North. That's how they see us. And so we are aligned with them, and we also are, as far as the King of the North is concerned, the most powerful nation, and so we're the one that they have to bring down first and foremost in order to advance their goal. Now, let's look at some ironies. I said we would review and then we would look at some ironies. We've already discussed this irony. It's interesting that the fellow on the left, if you don't recognize him, is the Shah of Iran. He was installed by the West to rule over the area of Persia, modern-day Iran. And a man that was also a Persian, his name is Ayatollah Khomeini, and he didn't like the Shah. He wanted to set up a Muslim government in that country under Sharia law. And so the Shah had to go, and he sought to foment revolution. The Shah said, sorry, this isn't good. You're going to have to leave the country. So Ayatollah Khomeini went to Iraq and then ultimately on to France. And from there, he sought to undermine the Shah. And so that was his full-time occupation, getting rid of the Shah and seeing himself self-installed as the head of a religious government. And he wasn't making too much headway until this man got involved. So in 1976, this man was elected president. His name is Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter got involved in this situation. He got involved in it as a Christian. And he basically saw the Shah as an abuser of human rights. And here's this poor religious guy, the Ayatollah Khomeini, and the Shah is standing in his way and oppressing these religious people, and we need to intervene in order to give them the freedom to practice their religion. And basically, this is a popular uprising, and we want to be a part of it. So he helped to establish the Ayatollah Khomeini as Iran's new dictator, which then became a theocracy of Allah. This wasn't the outcome he wanted, but it's the outcome that played out. The Carter administration supported that, not realizing what they were doing, and unfortunately, they had one goal in mind and one outcome in mind, and that's not what eventually played out. So, unfortunately, when the Ayatollah took over, the purge of those who were against him was quite significant. Many more people died under the Ayatollah Khomeini than what we thought. And you know what? We thought when we help him be installed and his government to take over, that he's going to be our friend. That was not the case. Shortly after the Ayatollah took over, in November of 1979, they took over the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, and they took 52 Americans hostage, and that hostage crisis went on for 440 days, and it cost Jimmy Carter his presidency. And also, by the overthrow of the Shah and the establishment of Ayatollah Khomeini, it advanced the current rise of the King of the South. If you look at the advancement of Islam and the pushing of jihad, the Iranians have been at the heart of it. Using money, using influence, they've greatly been involved in the expansion of jihad. So the Iran was not our friend, but they are our enemy, and they continue to poke at us. Currently, they're poking at us in the Strait of Hormuz, telling us that they're going to attack us and come after us and eventually shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and they'll open it when they see fit. So there's a struggle going on there, and the question is whether we will blink or not. That's going to be an interesting question. So anyway, we have the Ayatollah Khomeini taking over, and it didn't work out like we wanted it to or expected it to. In fact, it's come back to haunt us. Another irony here is that right on the heels of the hostage crisis in Iran, we have the Russians invading Afghanistan. And so the Russians felt that America was weak, and therefore they could go ahead and invade in Afghanistan, and that didn't work out for them. And as we're recognizing more and more every day, it's not working out for us either. Really, what is there in Afghanistan that we want other than to wipe, you know, basically destroy the training camps for the terrorists there in Afghanistan, and we probably should have moved on. But since the Soviets had been our enemies in the Cold War, the U.S. Went ahead and fought the Taliban Taliban in Afghanistan. They helped them to defeat the Soviets. We armed them. We sent advisors in, and we sent lots of armaments in there. And like somebody said, we sent lots of armaments in there, so everybody in every village has a rocket launcher, or all these weapons and things, which ultimately have come back to haunt us. So from the roots of the Soviet-Afghanistan war came the birth of Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Hamas, and other terrorist groups. And we helped to set the stage for that. And again, it's an irony. It's not what we planned or wanted, but we helped to establish those groups dedicated to our destruction. Not just the destruction of the U.S., but to the West as a whole and the establishment of a Muslim state. A third irony is this. After World War II, Europe was devastated. Its infrastructure was destroyed. They had lost millions of workers, and the financial system was a mess, and basically Europe was a basket case. So how do we bail them out? The United States came up with the idea of rebuilding Europe through what's called the Marshall Plan. So we invested millions of dollars to help rebuild Europe, to rebuild its industry, to rebuild its financial system, to rebuild the whole system there in Europe. The interesting thing is that with that funding, Europe began to rebuild. And as you think about it, all of the efforts that we put into it constitute the third irony, is that we financed and helped to rebuild and set the stage for the coming beast power. We did a lot to help bring that about by all of the things that we did. And that wasn't our intention, but they would not have gotten on their feet like they have if it hadn't been for us. And we allowed them to grow and to prosper because we protected them. We protected Europe since World War II. They've not had to spend money on armaments. They've not had to spend that money because we provided the protection. We've had troops in Germany and various parts of Europe, and all of that was for the purpose of protecting Europe from the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc for a long time. And so they've been able to have socialized medicine and spend their money on other things when we have footed the military bill for them. However, we can't continue to do that. Then we have a fourth irony concerning the European Union. As the European Union rebuilt and prospered, they needed more than schools, businesses, and public works. Does anybody know what they needed? They needed what? No, not a currency. They needed a currency, but they needed something else. If you build factories, what do you need for the factory? Fuel. You need workers, and that's what they lacked. So where did the European Union go for workers? Where? They went to the Middle East. And so they brought all these workers from the Middle East into their countries in order to work in their factories because they didn't have enough young men to fill all of those roles. And as the result of that, the intention was that they would come and they would assimilate, but they've not assimilated. So basically you've imported the Muslim Islam into your country. So now Europe has a gargantuan and growing problem. the Muslim population in Europe is growing at a much faster rate than their native populations. And they have gained more political power and influence. You know, as your population grows, all those people can vote. And eventually, they grow to the point where they vote the way they feel that things should go. So the European Union has done all of this, and it's all eventually created a big problem for them. So, we're well aware that prophetically 10 kings are to arise. As it tells us in Revelation 17, verse 12, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings. 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So this kingdom is to be set up. It will appears it will be a resurrection of the Roman Empire. And my question to you is, how will the kingdom arise when Europe may not survive long into the future because of demographics? And why are demographics important? There's some things that are interesting to consider here as far as demographics are concerned. Demographics are basically the study of population. So we can go into all kinds of intricate details, but that's basically what it is, the study of population and the trends that go with it. So we're going to look at the Muslim birth rates in Europe and why they are significant to those nations. I've used a couple of books in looking at this. One was called America Alone by Mark Stein, and a second book is called They Must Be Stopped by Bridget Gabriel. And both of those books are quite interesting in what they tell you about this particular issue. Not that they address it from a big biblical point of view, but they do give you some interesting things. And as you think about this issue, what's the most significant problem facing the world today? Is it global warming or the rise of Islamic fundamentalism? Global warming's really not a major issue in comparison to the issue of Islamic fundamentalism. And it's a very difficult issue to resolve. In 1970, no one thought much about Islam. If you remember back, if you were alive in 1970, I was 1 year out of high school in 1970, and really it wasn't on anybody's radar. Nobody thought about it. It wasn't a problem. And even the Palestinian situation was seen within the framework of being more of an ethnic issue, a battle between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and it wasn't a global issue at all. However, things have changed. Today it's Islam-a-go-go. Almost every geopolitical crisis takes place on what one individual called the clash of civilizations. The boundary between Eurasia and Africa that separates Muslims from non-Muslims. It's almost always in the news. There's an attack going on someplace. And it seems to be all too common. You have an attack in India, in Mumbai, a bomb in Bali, an uprising in an Islamic Republic. We have all of that going on today. The Madrid problems and London, and suddenly Islam is in the heart of the West. And we see this picture of what took place in Madrid, Spain. In many ways, the West is not significantly different than it was in 1970. But it's more up to date, but not a whole lot different. And yet, demographically, the world is very different. In 1970, the developed nations had twice as big a share of the global population as was found in the Muslim world, 30% to 15%. In 2000, there was parity. The West had 20% and Islam had 20%. And by 2020, the Islamic world is going to have many more people in it than we have. As you think about this subject, this here was the image that's been burned into all of our minds, something we remember from September 11th, 2001. I know that I was working on a project with a friend of mine, and I'll always remember what took place that day. And probably all of you will as well. I know my son was home, and he came out and told me, "Hey, they just flew some planes into some buildings in New York." Really? What's the big deal with that? Well, once we found out what exactly was going on there, it was a big deal. And what's significant about this is 9/11 was not the day that everything changed, but the day that revealed how much everything had changed. Well, on that day, if you went back and looked in the Rolodexes of various important people, would they have had Islamic organizations in their Rolodex? In most cases, no. But trust me, they all have them in there today, because the world has changed. If you said something causing offense to Muslims would be the 21st century's principal political dynamic in Denmark, in Sweden, Netherlands, Belgium, France, and the UK back in 1970, everybody would have laughed at you. But they are serious problems. There are serious problems there today. On 9/11, basically the tip of the iceberg popped to the surface. And on 9/11, the king of the south pushed at the king of the north in a way that really got their attention. And their goal is to destroy or bring into submission all infidels, and that is still their goal. So as you think about the world ahead, we have a way of life in the West, but our population is dwindling. And this is especially true in Europe. In a culture where everybody is in agreement, 90%, let's say, agree on what the culture should be like, you don't have a problem. But when you have a 60-40 split, you do begin to have some problems. You begin to have some disagreements. So where will the children of the future come from? The children that are going to cause things to take a certain direction. Increasingly, they will come from people who are at odds with the modern world and have a different perspective. And they're the ones that are going to drive the future. And depending on their mindset, they're going to, if we're not careful, they're going to bring about basically a new dark age if we're not careful. So let's think about birth rates for a little while. Currently, the U.S. partners with Europe, the G8 and NATO, but what happens when all of those partners are gone? Developed nations are declining. Canada, Europe, Japan are getting old fast. To keep up with keep a steady population, you need 2.1 births per woman. 2.1 births per woman. And I believe in the United States, when Mark Stein wrote his book, it was 2.11 in the United States. And the reason that it's 2.11 in the United States isn't because the white Anglo-Saxons are having more kids, it's because of the influx of people from immigration. That's what's doing it for us. And in Canada, they're having 1.48 children per woman. In Europe, 1.38, Japan, 1.32, and 1.14 in Russia. It's such a big problem in Russia that they're promoting having children. They want Russians to have, they're actually incentivizing with money. So have more kids, you'll get a certain financial breaks. And as you think about that, if you're not reproducing yourself, basically you're going out of business as a nation. Consider France. Have you ever thought about why wouldn't France go into Iraq or Afghanistan with us? Why wouldn't France go to war with us? Michelle? There's a large Muslim population. 30% of your cities are Islamic. So if you go to war, you're going to stir that population up. You don't want to do that. So we're not going to war. So that's the challenge. In the city of Rotterdam, in the Netherlands, the Muslim population is 40%. The most popular name in Belgium, Amsterdam, and Malmo, Sweden is Mohammed. It is the fifth most popular name in England. Sorry, in the UK. Now, interestingly, as you think about English, English is the language that is a worldwide language. And why is that? Now, you can say, well, God, because God blessed Abraham, and that's true. But in the way that God did bless the descendants of Abraham is what's interesting. The language of the English is the language of global business and the internet and the United States, which is the chief power of our time, in dozens of countries all over the world. And the reason is something that took place back about 200 years ago. In the early 19th century, the first nation to conquer infant mortality was England. And before then, England was like every other nation. But once they conquered infant mortality, their population began to explode. And by the 1820s, half their population was 15 or younger. And so they had surplus manpower. When you have half your population that's 15 and younger, really, that's a problem. Because those younger people are usually your active criminals and all of that. So you need to ship these people out. And that's what they did. English kids went all over the world, to the United States, to Canada, to Australia, and all around the world because they had excess population. And therefore, they spread all over the world, and so now you have English that's spread all over the world. It's just a logical outcome. So moving on here, why is the West population declining? The reason is they're not having kids. See, this is the West right here. You know, all of us. And in other parts of the world, they're growing by leaps and bounds as far as population is concerned. And as fertility dries up, so do societies. And so it's a serious issue. Demography is the most obvious symptom of a civilization that is in decline. We're having less kids. So as you think about the workforce of the future, where are they going to come from? So if Europeans and Canadians can no longer be bothered to have children, where's the workforce going to come from? It's going to come from immigration. And no problem, but you have to think about where are those talented immigrants from overpopulated areas coming from? They're coming from those nations with high birth rates. And when you look at the majority of the people that are immigrating, they're from Islamic countries. Islam is the principal supplier of Europeans and the second biggest supplier of Canadians. And many of these, we don't know exactly the percentage, but a significant percentage of these individuals, their goal is the establishment of a Muslim state and Sharia law. As you look at America has always been about assimilation. Maybe if you remember back to your time in high school, they talked about America being a melting pot. And at one time it used to be, but it's not any longer. You have people that are immigrating to our country and they're not assimilating. And in Europe, it's the same thing. You can have Vietnamese, Italians, and Greeks come into our nation or Europe, and they'll assimilate. You know, it's like always remember there was a commercial that was on, and there was a Chinese girl there, and she spoke, and she sounded just like somebody from Oklahoma. Okay, you looked at her; she looked to have an Asian background, but she spoke like somebody from Oklahoma. And you know, they had assimilated; they had adopted the society and all of that. But what happens with Islam, in many cases, they don't assimilate. So if an American or a Scot marries a Muslim, many times they convert to being Muslims. And they do not assimilate as others do. And that's not everybody, but it's a significant percentage where it becomes a problem. So could we be seeing the death of the West? I don't believe that we're going to die. There's going to be another outcome. But this is all setting up a major crisis, if you think about it. So the thing is, how is it going to play out? That's the question. An interesting quote from the guy on the right. He's no longer living, but he still can be quoted. He's been overthrown since the time when I gave this. His name is Muammar Gaddafi. And he said, There are signs that Allah will grant Islam victory in Europe. Without swords, without guns, without conquest, the 50 million Muslims of Europe will turn it into a Muslim continent within a few decades. And that process is afoot. And as I said, the goal of Islam is to dominate the world, to establish a caliphate all over the world. And it's interesting the way that they're influencing things. For instance, in Linz, Austria, Muslims are demanding that all teachers, believers and infidels, wear headscarves. Everybody wear a headscarf. The Muslim Council of Britain wants Holocaust Day abolished because it focuses only on the Nazis' alleged Holocaust of the Jews and doesn't talk about the Holocaust that's taking place in the Gaza Strip with the Palestinians. In Seville, King Ferdinand III can no longer serve as a patron saint of the annual fiesta because his splendid record for independence from the Moors is considered insensitive to the Muslims living in that part of the world. The Church of England considered the removal of St. George as the country's patron saint because he's too militaristic and offensive to the Muslims. If they are making cultural changes in Europe, how far behind the trend are we? And those things are happening here too. So basically, they're seeking to change the culture, and they're using the freedoms that we have in order to bring about these changes, in order to achieve their purpose. So the question is, why do they hate us? That's a big question that a lot of people have. Why do they hate us? Well, they hate us because of our culture, but goal and purpose is not just to blow themselves up and all of that. It is to establish the caliphate around the world. That's why you have the suicide bombers and all of those kind of things, and why they say Allah Akbar, basically Allah is supreme and all of that. That's what they're promoting. That's what they're pushing for. So as you look at Europe and the future, Europe figures that it's going to need 50 million workers in order to keep going in the next few years just to maintain a big enough working population to fund the lavish social programs its vast retired army of baby boomers needs. And the only available sources of immigrants aren't found in Europe. They have to go outside of Europe and primarily to Islamic countries. So the question is, what happens if the Muslim threat continues to rise in Europe? What action might they take? What happens if taking more immigrants from Muslim nations becomes a threat to the vitality of the European Union? Another question, might this be fulfilled by an enslavement of the English-speaking people, that time that's called Jacob's Trouble? So if you come to the point where we do not want the King of the South's people working for us, we will get these English-speaking people and use them. Something to think about. What are we going to be doing as the time of Jacob's trouble comes on the scene, and where are they going to get those people to do the work in their factories? Now, is that how it's going to play out? I don't know, but it's something interesting to consider. In 1492, several interesting things happened. We're well aware that Columbus discovered the New World. That's one outcome. Also, in that year, the Jews were expelled from Spain. Also in 1492, the Moors, the followers of Islam, were expelled from Spain. And it's interesting to me that as the King of the North begins to push at the, or King of the South pushes at the King of the North, might it be possible that the Europeans are finally going to wake up and say, you know what, you guys need to leave because you're a threat. Your goal is to, and they're going to cause so much difficulty there that they will expel them. They say that'll never happen. Well, stranger things have happened. You know, you've had The Babylonians escort millions of people away from Judah and Israel. It could happen in our time as well. And they're much more efficient today than they were back then. So we'll see what happens. Might they expel them from Europe, and then they're going to need workers? And might the people of, that are descendants of Jacob be a part of that? 2050, significant year, because that's the year that they figured that the Muslim population is going to reach its peak and begin going down. So everything that's going to take place has to take place before 2050, if current trends continue. And I don't pretend to be clairvoyant or say that's exactly how it's going to be. This is just one way that things may work out. One of the things that we have to realize is that America is in decline. We're, you know, you always hear people accuse individuals of being Laodicean. Well, we live in an Laodicean age. All you have to do is look at our country and you realize that we're operating as a world power that's very wealthy when in fact we're trying to be a world power and we don't have the budget to do what we would like to do. And that's and as America declines, there's going to be a vacuum that somebody's going to fill. And if we do not have the money to provide military protection for Europe, then Europe is going to have to fill that vacuum, aren't they? And if we have to withdraw from our influence in the Middle East and in other parts of the world, then somebody's going to fill it, the Chinese or the Muslims or someone. So all of these things are taking place, and it is interesting to watch the news and see what happens. Let's go to Psalm 83. Psalm 83. The Bible talks about these things and gives us hints about what's going to happen. Psalm 83. It says in Psalm 83, let's begin in here, and it's talking about what is eventually to play out in our time, and speaks of these nations that are to come. Let's begin in verse 1. It says, "Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace. And do not be still, O God, for behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people, and consulted together against your sheltered ones. They have said, 'Come, and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more.' For they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you. The tents of Edom." Edom is, we find the Palestinians and some of the Turks that make up Edom. And the Ishmaelites, Arabs in general. It says Moab, central Jordan. And the Hagrites, northern Arabians, and Gebel, which is a mountain region of Jordan, Ammon, which is again the environments of Ammon, Jordan, and Amalek, a branch of the Edomite Palestinians, you know, with the inhabitants of Tyre. And so we find you know, this alliance, this confederation that's going to form. Interestingly, look who's another member. It says Assyria also has joined with them, and they have helped the children of Lot. So there's a confederation to come, and all of this is to play out as the end of the age comes about. So the Arab Spring has taken place, and it is interesting what has gone on there. And you have all this upheaval and overturning, and the United States played a part in all of that. Again, it's an ironic situation where we want those dictators to fall to allow all this oppression to end and democracy to be established. But is that what's happened? What's happened is Islamic governments have been established based upon Sharia law. They've become the ones that are dominating. And it's not worked out like we planned it. Now, how is it ultimately going to play out? We'll have to wait and see. But it's not worked out like we wanted it to, just as it didn't work out in Jimmy Carter's time. So It'll be interesting to watch what's taken place in the Arab Spring. We're now in the Arab winter, and it's not worked out like we thought it would. So where do we go from here? What is the ultimate goal of the King of the South? Who is the King of the South? Well, I think the ultimate goal reveals who the King of the South really is. And the ultimate goal of those who are leading the new Islamic Jihad is to create a worldwide caliphate in all parts of the world ruled by Islam under Sharia law. One thing is for sure, the King of the South is going to continue to push at the King of the North. And the pushing from the King of the South will continue until it forces a resurrection of the Roman Empire. And as that takes place, you'll have the political side of it, and you'll also have the religious side of it. A recent quote from a leading cleric says this: "The Prophet Muhammad was asked, what city will be conquered first, Constantinople or Rome? He answered, the city of Constantinople will be conquered first." And Constantinople was conquered in 1453 by Islam. "The other city, Rome, remains, but we hope and believe that it too will be conquered." Their goal is to conquer Europe and overwhelm its religion. Why? Because it's been the Roman Catholic Church that has rallied Christendom to fight against Islam. In the Crusade, at the Battle of Tours, Lepanto, at the gates of Vienna. And it will be the Roman Catholic Church that will once again help to inspire and to push the King of the North to fight against the King of the South. So hopefully this gives you some insight into the subject of the King of the South. Does it answer everything? Maybe it doesn't answer anything. Maybe it creates more questions than you had before. But watch the news, and you'll see all of this. I think it's going to unfold before our very eyes, and it is an amazing thing to see the prophecies of the Bible unfold before us.